Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Some 30 years ago, more than 100,000 ethnic Nepalis were forced from their homes in Bhutan. After 20 years of limbo, living and raising families in a refugee camp, 20,000 Bhutanese Nepali have made a home, a new home, in Columbus. Their stories are the subject of a new photo exhibit opening May 5th at the Ohio History Center. Coming up, we're going to meet the photographer and the writer who partnered on this project. Joining us now is Executive Director of the Bhutanese Nepali Community Center and former refugee, Sudarshan Pierre Krill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How long had the Nepali ethnic minority made their homes in Bhutan?
So generally we think it is, not we think, but there's enough evidence that we have been there for five generations. So the earliest migration actually started in Bhutan in 1620 or 1624. But the larger migration actually started in early 19th century, and it went way to maybe early 20th century.
Now, was it considered a particular ethnic minority migrating to another place at the time?
No, it wasn't. It was more like an economic, slow, progressive migration because that part of the land, if you see in the map, is more like the extended Himalayan people living there. And then they were in. So Nepali people were predominantly farmers. So they needed more land, right, as you are farming for some times in a land. And there was a slow progressive migration to look for more land. So that is how we end up being in part of the Bhutan. So technically, even we were not migrating because at that time in history, there was a country called Bhutan, but this border weren't there, right? When only India became independent in 1947, actually this border were drawn. So kind of by default, we were in part where Bhutan is now. So that's how we were there.
You know, I actually interviewed someone maybe like 4 or 5 years ago who had written a book about that because Bhutan had been named the happiest place on earth or something. Mm-hmm. What happened?
So it's a kind of irony that the fourth king of Bhutan, Jigmesme Wangchuck, who is responsible for evicting more than 100,000 people from the tiny little kingdom, actually, amazingly started this concept called gross national happiness, which is an irony. But the concept in itself, I like the concept in itself, but Bhutan need to acknowledge the fact that, you know, there was an ethnic cleansing in the south. You know, people who have been living there for five generations were kicked out of their home, and there was a forceful eviction. Military was used. A lot of people were tortured, put into jail. You know, international organizations are pretty much used. You know, known to the fact that there was atrocity in southern Bhutan in the 90s and, you know, early 90s. So given the fact that Bhutan could claim the happiest nation in the world is kind of an irony, but, you know, I think it's a political move by the king to, you know, to cover up what happened in the early 90s.
Why that ethnic minority? What was the problem with that?
So, if you see Bhutan from the you know, population wise kind of group, there are three major groups. There are Ngalungs, which is the ruling group, and then there are Sharshops. They are both Buddhist and northern tribes, and then there are Nepalis. We are called Lochampa, southern Bhutanese. So we have been there, and then the tension. I think when Bhutan got its new map in 1947 and later in 1972.
When it got its new what?
New map, the country's map, right? The maps were drawn,
okay,
like when British leave.
Maps, okay, gotcha. Sorry,
maps were drawn.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So the regime in the north began to feel this threat, kind of. People, we were living in the south. Bhutan is a mountainous region, and if you see that, only 5 to 7% of the land is actually suitable for agriculture. And majority of that land, you can say 90% of that land is in the south. So people in the south were occupying majority of the agricultural land. Bhutan depended on agriculture, predominantly agriculture even today. And then you can see the economic prosperity in south when Bhutan introduced modern education. Actually, the people in the south begin to, you know, take that opportunity. And the first batch of so-called the teachers, doctors, whoever the skilled labor were, majority of them were from south. So it was kind of political economic threat to the North, because North has a symbolic hold to the power. They were dynastic and ruling the country. So I think it was a panic action that King took to consolidate power. And then if you see geographically, the people who are evicted from South, you'll see from southern region that has routes to the North. So they were trying to clear ways to the North always to consolidate power for, you know, for a generation for the Wangchuck dynasty to rule.
So the wealth tended to be in the South. The power tended to be in the North. They just wanted to bring it all together. And one way to do that was to eliminate 100,000 people.
Very correctly. So wealth was in the South. And then when Bhutan kicked out the people from South, it started its own resettlement process. People from the North were brought to South and then rehabilitated in the South.
Many have spent more than 20 years in a refugee camp, and there are about 10,000 people still living in that camp, from what I understand, 10 or 12,000 people. Why such a long time? What was the holdup? Why couldn't they? Why was the diaspora so slow to come?
Yeah, that's really a great question. It took more than 20 years. By now, it's almost 24 years. Bhutan and Nepal started a high-level dialogue between two countries to solve this issue. And then there are more than 14 rounds of talk between Bhutan and Nepal, and they did not go anywhere. And India was a major player, but India was very silent and did not make any comment on this process. So without the signaling from India, I guess that's my personal opinion, Bhutan and Nepal could not come to any decision. And then that took 14, 15 years. And then only after that. So I have to go a little bit back that when refugees are accepted, when United Nations accepts refugees, there's a different process, a waiting process that everybody cannot be refugee. So we can go on into that. But
the idea of being identified as a refugee is a process in and of itself, right?
So when United Nations accepts refugees, there are three conditions. You know, either they will be repatriated, taken back to the country of their origin, or assimilation. The host country accepts the refugee and they become part of their population. And then the third option is resettlement. And then, when United Nations and other agencies were exhausted with trying two options, the third option was repatriation. So it took a long time to come to this end. We were staying there in limbo for a very, very long time.
Why was it difficult to get refugee status for this 100,000 people, 100,000 plus? Obviously, they were refugees.
Well, in the beginning, when you are evicted out of your country, it's not so easy that, agencies will just go and then accept you as a refugee. United Nations has to come, and then the nation has to decide why there is an issue, and then there should be a legitimate issue. And even we have to prove ourselves that we did not came from anywhere else, but we came from the place where there is an issue or, struggle going on. So you have to have a government documents to support that. My parents were Bhutanese citizens and things like that.
Yeah. What were the camps like? What are they like? Because like I said, there's about 12,000 people still in them.
Yeah. In the beginning, camp was a very chaotic place. You don't want to be in that place. It's summer, humid, and then, that part of the Nepal rains pretty well. And then we were living in a small tent house. There are hundreds of thousands of people in a very proximity, very close. And then you don't want to imagine even what was life in camp. But I would say after 2 years, things began to be settled. There were camps were organized. There was, sanitary system was established, and there was a supply of water, drinks, food, and everything came. So that makes things a little bit in order. But overall, life in camp is not something that, anyone has to go through.
Yeah, it's always a wonder to people who have never experienced that kind of hardship, mm-hmm. that to imagine raising a family in a refugee camp. Not only that, but to begin families in refugee camp. I mean, it's 20 years. You have to keep going.
Right. A whole generation grew up in camp. And then now we're seeing the impact of that living in camp for 20 years. The younger generation tend to feel very dependent towards agencies because that is what they have seen.
Dependent on others,
right? Yeah. Agencies. Because you have no means to make your own ends
meet. You're forced to be.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you are looking for agencies, whether that's for school, whether that's for education, whether that's for recreation. And then that generation still have that mindset of, I don't think, because of the living in a camp for so long. And it's very, very hard because parents have no choice. What do you want to say to your kids? How do you want to raise? What dream you want to give to your kids? Like, it is continuous nurturing and talking to your kids about future. And then there is no future. You are living in a chaos. You don't talk about what is going to happen tomorrow. It's just about, okay, we are making our living. Hopefully we'll survive. That's the scenario.
When I was reading the descriptions, and we'll get to this more later, but a lot of people would leave the camp to work outside illegally. It seemed to be sort of an unspoken, yeah, all right, you got to do what you got to do just to feed their families.
Right. A lot of young youths, especially who could not, you know, continue education after maybe 10th grade, because up to 10th grade, schooling was provided in camp. So now after that, they have no way to pay their tuition fees, and then only, you know, the well-to-do families, so-called well-to-do within the camp, could afford their kids to go to private school in Nepal. So this young, you know, young generation need money to support themselves, to support their family, and they would go. They were kind of illegally smuggled by a contractor who would be doing road construction or mining construction in a dangerous area.
Yeah.
And even a large majority of people were working in coal mines in India illegally. And then, you know, there was an explosive use in those coal mines.
Because they were working illegally.
Right, illegally.
And
then safety gears were never provided. And a lot of the young folks now who are in their 30s came up with PTSD, right? Because they were exposed to so much of that noises, you know, blast and all those things. Yeah, so it's every way you see it, even if they were employed, they were exploited. Even when they were staying in camp, there was no hope. So overall, it was, you know.
Yeah. Why, Shirshan, why did they come to Columbus? What was the appeal?
Okay, this is very interesting. So when the resettlement process started, we were kind of randomly sent to different states and different cities. Majority of people were, in my understanding, were sent to southern states like Texas, Arizona, Georgia. So, and that was the, and people began to feel like, you know, we have to make our ends meet, right? Even in the United States, we have to find a job.
Yeah.
And these are the people with limited skill. They don't have exposure to, you know, Western way of life. They have never driven a car or no experience at all. And if one person in a family could ride a car, that would be a driver for a whole family member, whether that is job or hospital appointment. So now people begin to realize that where is the job opportunity, where I can make, you know, money to pay my bills. And I would honestly say that Columbus tend to be that place, job opportunity. You know, you can go meet your family member once in a year or, you know, twice a year, but you need to pay your bills every single month. So people quickly realize that. And Columbus opened that opportunity. Overall, Ohio, I would say, opened that opportunity. And Columbus tend to be the most welcoming city. To be honest with you, the way the city has provided, you know, welcoming kind of gestures, and then the agencies working, hospital, schools, they have been very welcoming to this population. That's how we end up coming here.
Shudarshan Piyakril, you're a refugee as well, or you were a refugee. I don't know how, when you let go of that status or not. How does that work?
So, I don't know. I think it's an individual thing. Even I am still attached with that, my refugee status today. But now I'm a citizen, so, you know, technically I let it go, but I'm attached to my refugee status. And then I'll be with my refugee status mentally, that I was a refugee. I'll be advocating for refugees, and then the call, you know, how we can help other people who were in those situations. So I don't want to say I'm totally, you know, out of that box.
Now an American citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Shudarshan Piyakril is the executive director of the Bhutanese Nepali Community Center. We are talking about that community today because there is an exhibit opening up at the Ohio History Center this weekend. We'll talk more about that coming up with the photographer and the writer who worked together on this project. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A photo exhibit entitled Bhutanese-Nepali Neighbors opens this weekend at the Ohio History Center. You can find out more about that with the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking about the 20,000-plus Bhutanese-Nepali who have made their home in Columbus after spending 20-plus years in a refugee camp. It is Ohio's largest current-day refugee group. Still with us is the executive director of the Bhutanese-Nepali Community Center and a former refugee himself, Sudarshan Piyakril. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And now joining us now are the two men behind the exhibit, award-winning documentary photographer Tariq Terry. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also award-winning poet and essayist Doug Rutledge. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
The photographs and the text are arranged in a certain sequence intended to emphasize the history of the Bhutanese-Nepali's refugee experience. How does it begin, Doug Rutledge?
It begins with a marvelous photograph of Hasta Dutal. But what we're trying to do is line up people who had experience of being in Bhutan and then people whose experience was primarily in the refugee camp and then people who talk more about being in Columbus. As you say, people were in the refugee camp for 20 years and more, so families grew up there, so it's a kind of generational split.
It starts with kind of old to young in one way, Tariq, and the photographs are, well, they're just splendid. They're so beautiful. What was that like? What were you trying? How do you capture?
Well, thank you. One of the most important thing to, obviously, as a documentarian, is to be authentic. And our job was to make sure that when people came to the studio for Doug and I to interview and photograph, there was no sense of posing. There was no sense of, no, you have to wear this type of color or that type of color.
Right.
Some people chose to wear their traditional clothing. And some people were to wear their Western as they came from work or they were going to work. So to keep it as authentic as possible.
Like, who are you today?
Who are you today and what culture are you from to preserve that as well? But more importantly also is the going deeper into the people and learning more about them through photography and through Doug's writing. To get to know our new neighbors. That was more important to us.
So the older people would tend to arrive more traditionally garbed in all things being equal. It wasn't true across the board, but...
No, I didn't...
Because they still identified more with the culture they came from, or...?
Well, older folks definitely did.
Right.
And definitely because of the refugee camp... As Sudarshan was talking about, some people, the education went up to the 10th grade, so the younger generation spoke English when they came, and it was easy to communicate. The older generation tend to not have that English language communication. So traditionally, they were dressed, you know, to their traditional.
How did you conduct your interviews and that kind of thing, Doug Rutledge?
Well, one of the things I'd like to say is this project and the projects we've worked on before depend a lot on trust, that people aren't going to tell you about their lives unless they trust you.
Right.
And Tariq and I have been in the community helping people access resources, get jobs for a long time. So we've built up relationships with people. Once people know who you are and trust what you're doing, they're more willing to share with you. And the idea was to allow people to tell their story the way they wanted to tell it so that we could document them with dignity. But the trust factor means a lot. The community has to believe in you because it's important to recognize that these people don't know what a photographic exhibition is. And they have a very different concept of history than Americans do. Time is not the same. So to try to say that we're creating a photo exhibition is meaningless. What matters is that they have a relationship with you, they trust you, and that they believe you're trying to advocate for them. And as long as that's the case, then they'll share their stories with you.
Sudarshan Pierre Krull, what's that like? Something like this project, how does the community embrace it or not? I mean, are there some people that think it's not valuable, or how do they approach it?
So I have my personal take and what community feel about it. When Dog and Tariq first came to BNCC, they were trying before I came to BNCC to do this exhibit actually last year, right? And then I heard about this exhibit, and I'm an anthropology student. I was excited, and I immediately feel that, okay, this is very important thing to do in this time, because it is going to stay in a very important place, right? This is going to be a marker in the history, right? We won't be able to get this exhibit once again. And this is going to stay there for generations, and our, you know, kids would be able to go see, visit how we were when we came to United States, what kind of dresses we wear, what food we eat, what we used
because
to talk
eventually
like. Right.
They'll get westernized.
Yeah,
eventually this will fade.
Yeah. This will fade, and it will be a very important document for them to see even 200 years from now if they wanted to know who their ancestors were. So that was the excitement for me myself, and I'm heavily involved with it. But with the community, they would say, well, we have taken so many photos, right? They would not differentiate between the photograph that they have in their house that they would keep for their personal memory than the photograph that is in the exhibit. So I'm not saying to all, but for most of the people, that is the concept. But there are educated people, too, who have been to universities, who are professors, had professions. They would admire and they would admit the fact that this is very important. But to a larger population, it's just something that they don't think it is very important for them.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Tariq. You know, I saw the exhibit or much of it on Friday beforehand, and it was still being assembled and so forth. But when I went to a 5K for a refugee community the next day, I didn't just necessarily recognize people from the exhibit in it, but I recognized who the Bhutanese Nepali were in that group.
Absolutely.
It's very distinctive and rich and beautiful in many, many ways. What, as a writer, did you find distinctive about this group, Doug Rutledge?
It's a very smart question. The people are humble, and so humble that often they don't understand why you're trying to interview them. And what seems important to me doesn't always seem important to the people who experienced it. So, but what I tried to do is get people to tell special stories and then edit them in ways that they talk to each other. So that if you'll allow me to make a comparison, Robert Frost said that if you're writing a book of 35 poems, the 36th poem should be the book itself. And I want to say that these came together. If you think of each of the bios as a kind of prose poem, they speak to each other, so that one person will tell you how he made a little extra money baking bricks and using them for the base of the bamboo homes. And then they would put stakes in the homes and weave the bamboo for the walls and put thatch on top. And another person will tell you how the bamboo homes were very prone to fire. And when the fire started, it would spread very fast. And their home burned, and they lost the little money they had, and their bike burned, and they were using that to get to the city to buy minor supplies. And another person will tell you that when the river floods, the snakes come up from the river and nest in the thatch of the roof, and how his wife screamed when the cobra was weaving through the roof. So that when the essays speak to each other, you begin to get a sense of what it's like to be in the refugee camp and how unstable life was and how people had to struggle to survive. So it's that, getting people to tell their stories in a way that what seems unimportant to them is really important and to get them to explain it. Yeah.
And it's interesting when you describe it that way, because my impression from it, you know, from reading about it and reading about the community and then seeing the exhibit, was the interconnectivity of the community. They are very close to each other, right?
Yeah. So some of my friends from Nepal also asked me, why your community is so neatly tied, right? We are Nepali. We share a lot of history. And I don't have a good, I think, answer, but what I know is this history that we share, the pain that we share, because we have been in camp for so many years, and then we were evicted out of country. We were not a privileged group. And then, you know, when people try to make friends, let's say someone who is outsider, we always begin to feel that way. Maybe they have certain privileges. They are different. They may see us differently. And then the community is so neatly, you know, come together in anything. Like the way people are buying house today here, the witness community is buying a house. And then sometimes people ask, how is that possible? We kind of crowdfunding do for a family member. So whenever there is a cause, whether there's a marriage, whether there's about buying home, whether there's a funeral, it's all we donate to family member. We donate to each other. So living for each other's cause is still so. I think the pain that we have, that we were refugees in a camp and then we had such a hard life, that brings us together and makes us uniquely different people.
Yeah. But little bits and pieces, everyone brings a little bit something to it. And then capturing that, you know, you hear about documentary filmmakers a lot, but not necessarily documentary photographers as much. It's clear what you're doing and what you've achieved it, but how does that play out visually, Tarek?
Well, as I was mentioning earlier, I mean, the documentary photography, it's a long history in America.
Absolutely.
I mean, as Doug and I always talk about, this Dorothea Lange, who photographed the, you know, early migration.
And particularly during the Depression. And,
exactly. You know. So America has its history of you know, documentary photographers. And in some sense, we're trying to follow that footsteps. And those footsteps are not within the United States. It's abroad. So people are coming abroad from a refugee camp to the United States, and we want to capture that. Capture it in a way that is authentic. It's real. Nothing is added. People are, their cultures and their traditions are preserved for future generations to access. And to me, and obviously to Doug and Suzarjan, who's sitting here with us, that's our focus, and that's what we want to maintain.
Is there more? I mean, is there a book? When I was watching it and reading, I was hoping I would read more and see more. Doug Rutledge?
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about putting a book together. We're talking about how best to do that. Yeah. May I quickly
sure.
say, with just to add what Tarek was saying, is at this point it might be really important to distinguish between a refugee and an immigrant.
Yeah.
That legally, according to the Geneva Convention,
a specific definition, yeah.
And the United States law, that a refugee is someone who has a viable fear of persecution. And they have rights within the United States that are almost equivalent to a citizen, except they can't vote until they become a citizen. An immigrant crosses a border for economic reasons, usually, to get a job, and they don't have those same rights. Refugee status is based on international treaty as well as American law, and immigrants don't come with that background.
Pam in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Well, thank you, Ann, and thanks to your guests. I'm really looking forward to the exhibition starting this weekend. It sounds wonderful. My question was regards to the initial separation between the people in the northern part of Bhutan and the southern part. And I was wondering, besides the power dynamic, what were the other factors involved with the two being distanced from each other? Was it ethnicity? Was it religion? Was it culture? Was it language? Was it all of the above? Why weren't they able to work side by side as neighbors?
Yeah, Shooter Jean-Pierre.
So that's a very interesting question to make a distinction here. I don't think religion or, of course, in the south, we are predominantly Hindus. We were following Hindu, and then the people in the north were Buddhist. But we never had a tension religiously, and then language. Of course, there was a linguistic difference. We have been living together for five generations, very peacefully coexisting there, and there have never been any riots or any dispute because, you know, within Hinduism and Buddhism, there's so much of interconnection, and Buddhism came out of Hinduism, and then there was respect for priests on, you know, educated scholars on both sides. But it's more a political, you know, the especially the regime, the king's family needed more power. So that's the only reason. Still today, there is a significant population in Bhutan who are Nepalese or Lhotshampas, and they have been living there. Of course, they are living not as the northern people having all the privileges, but it's all political reason, if you want to sum up that why there was this tension of power.
Thanks a lot, Pam, for that question. Yeah, Doug Rutledge?
Well, I just wanted to add, you're absolutely right that it's political. But laws were enforced to make people dress the same as the North, speak the same language as the North. People couldn't teach their children in their language. And they were also couldn't have their festivals. So while I agree with you, the reason is political, individual human beings were being persecuted for cultural reasons.
Right, right. I totally agree. Thank you for bringing up that one. Because in Bhutan, when I was in third grade in 1990, we weren't allowed to wear our dress. We weren't allowed to wear any school dress. We were actually forced to wear the traditional drukpa dress that the northern people wear. Nepali was taken out of the school, and Nepali teachers were fired right away. And then we were asked to speak the Jonka language. That's the they call national language. We have to change our life immediately to adopt and to look like Drukpa people. You dress like them. You follow culture like them. And we weren't allowed to.
And did some people do that?
We practiced that for a
you
while.
You had to
do
it.
Yeah, we had to do
it. But do some people remain? Bhutanese, Nepali remain in Bhutan?
Yeah, there are. There's mm-hmm. a significant population still in Bhutan.
And these are people who have assimilated into that.
Yeah, not kind of assimilation totally, but that lasted only for, let's say, 5 to 10 years only. Uh-huh. So, and then the previous king gave up the throne and then, gave it to his son. And then they democratized, the kind of democracy was brought into country. And there's now political parties ruling it, but it's all controlled by king. But that lasted for a decade, that oppressive kind of tight regime tactics.
There is a new exhibit opening at the Ohio History Center. It is entitled Bhutanese Nepali Neighbors. It starts this weekend. For more information, you can visit the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Better yet, stay with us because the photographer and the writer who put together the exhibit are with us, as well as Sudarshan Piyakril, Executive Director of the Bhutanese Nepali Community Center. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A photo exhibit entitled Bhutanese Nepali Neighbors opens this weekend at the Ohio History Center. We're talking about 20,000 Bhutanese Nepali who have made their home in Columbus after spending more than 20 years in a refugee camp. It is Ohio's largest current-day refugee group, but not its the only one. And we're going to talk a little bit about how the Somali refugees also kind of paved the way in some ways for Bhutanese Nepali refugees. Still with us is the executive director of the Bhutanese Nepali Community Center and a former refugee himself, Sudarshan Piyakril. He is with us, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And also with us, award-winning documentary photographer Tariq Terry. Welcome again.
Thank you.
And award-winning poet and essayist Doug Rutledge. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Ann.
How do you support an endeavor like this, Tariq? Who funds it? How does it? Who cares? enough to fund it. Let's put it that way.
Actually, the community, the larger community cares, especially the community that we're photographing. As Sudarshan was talking about, the BNCC and other people are recognizing it. But there's also a financial support that we couldn't have done, Doug and I couldn't have done this exhibit. And that's the Greater Columbus Arts Council, the Columbus Foundation, the Ohio Arts Council and Jewish Family Services, and also the Ohio Alliance League. So Buffum Foundation, Jewish Family Services, United Way, there's many Ethiopia. Other, and ETSS, the Ethiopian Tewahedo Social Services. And of course, the Ohio History Center itself for putting it together. So we couldn't have done it without the folks.
Yeah. Could I just quickly say that one of the things that was impressive when we visited the Ohio Arts Council and the Greater Columbus Arts Council, how much help, how enthusiastic people were for the project and how supportive they were. And I don't mean just money, but the way in which people helped us put together the grant, helped us think about the program. We got an email this morning from Mary Gray from the Ohio Arts Council just wishing us support. People have been really nice and enthusiastic about it, and we are deeply grateful.
We are.
Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Hold on. I'll get off speakerphone.
Thank you.
I live over off of Mays and Morse, and that's a very heavily populated Bhutanese and Nepalese area. And I did a project. I'm a photographer as well, and I was invited to a large show called 400 Women at 400 Rich Street. And the topic was, women. So I decided to turn it on its head, make it the diversity of women and the color of women and just the beauty of the of Columbus. And I got to meet two people, and I told them they could have their, I would give them a photograph. One of them is the woman who opened up the Bhutanese restaurant in Saraga. And the other one, I met her, and we just connected and had a relationship and didn't get to photograph her. One of the things is that there's another wave of refugees coming in from Myanmar. And they have similar situation coming from Myanmar, but it's just such a beautiful culture. And when I gave back the photograph, and again, like you were saying, that a photograph is just a photograph. I gave the photograph back to the owner of the restaurant, and I said, "Well, what do you think?" And she said, "I think I look tired."
Interesting.
I said, "Well, of course you're tired. You're one of the most successful restaurants in Columbus, let alone in our area." I can't wait to see the show either. And I'd love to talk more after the program's over. I know where the Bhutanese Center is, but maybe I could talk to you too. I did a volunteer program with refugees from Myanmar and a nonprofit photography group for kids. So. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, Beth, thank you so much for the call. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Doug, with Abdi Roble, you've written about the Somali diaspora, which, Doug, yeah. And would you compare and contrast the two experiences, that of the Somali exodus and the Bhutanese Nepali?
Sure.
about it.
Yeah. Well, let me make some big contrasts. In the 90s, the average stay in a refugee camp was 5 years. Yeah. In the 2000s, the average stay for all refugees is 20 years. So both groups spent a long time in refugee camps. There was protest and violence in the Nepali situation. I don't think it was. I think the Nepali situation was much more violent. So there was, in that sense, more trauma. The other thing that I would compare is that you mentioned earlier, I think we were off mic, but you mentioned the idea that the Somali population has sort of made things a little easier for following refugees. And I think that's true. I think Columbus itself has matured in ways you may well remember, Anne, that when there was a process of secondary migration, that is, people were settled in one place and coming to Columbus because it was a good place to live, mm-hmm. the city was responding negatively at first to the Somali people. They were closing off housing centers so that the homeless shelters were closed and other things were closed off. And when we talked to the mayor's office, people were saying, what are we going to do when all these people come? Gradually, Columbus has become more and more welcoming. Employers have become welcoming. As Sudarshan was pointed out, the community, the county has become more helpful. And I think that that has helped stabilize the Bhutanese-Nepali refugee status a lot faster. And in terms of just writing about it, when we were interviewing Somali folks, there was a lot more people wanted to tell their stories faster, I think, because there was more trouble involved. Here, it was a matter of getting to know people and working up, as we were saying earlier, the trust mm-hmm. and establishing relationships. It was almost more like news interviewing with the Somali people, whereas here it's a different kind of experience.
Yeah, Turk, does that resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, professionally, also part of not only being a photographer is I work for Jewish Family Services, and our job is to help individuals obtain employment as soon as they come to the United States. And remember, the funding for refugees is only a limited time that, you know, a county or refugee funds will go. So, you know, Doug and I both worked for Jewish Family Services, and our job was to make sure there's a livable wage and livable standards to do that. But what's more important, actually, people need to realize, in Columbus, there are 873 jobs created by refugees. That is asset in Columbus. So the government is realizing it, the county commissioners are realizing it, and individuals hopefully will recognize that. You know, and also, excuse me, a $1.6 billion contribution to our economy here in Franklin County. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's good. That's good for all of us, not only for refugees and not only for people on the left or not.
Well, all you have to do is drive down Morris Road. I mean, exactly. 15, 20 years ago, it would look like a ghost town, and now it's very vibrant, very different than it was before, but very vibrant.
Exactly.
Yeah, lots of businesses. What do we know about the Bhutanese-Nepali contribution to the economy?
Yes, Tariq was saying we can go into this figure, and there are so many studies done to prove that how Bhutanese community is contributing into the economy. Just a few days ago, I talked with one of the realtor, and he gave me this number that so far 650 families have brought home in Greater Columbus area, and then the average house was. The cost of average house was $164. So if you calculate that, just tax, they paid $1.5 million in tax, just buying home. And then the other businesses there are more than 20 businesses in Columbus, and they employ 2 to 3 people. So in that way, you can just keep calculating that there is a good economic contribution. And it's just the beginning only, because there's a spirit of being self-independent, you know, being independent. And then that spirit is rising, the way they are buying house, the way they are starting business, the way they are contributing towards the school and education, and then bringing awareness about health and other issues. So this community is moving towards the self-sufficiency. But, you know, in the beginning, it takes time because they were taken out of all their resources, not only resources, you know, making people feel that you are worthless, you don't deserve any, you know, a regular life being in a refugee camp. So that is kind of trauma. Now, people have started overcoming that trauma and begin to realize, oh, yeah, I am just like anyone else. I can do a business. I can start a new project. I can go to college. I can go to university and become a regular part of the community. So that realization is growing up. So that is not only going to contribute economically, it's going to contribute in far more better ways, you know, culturally, in terms of ideas, bringing new resources. So down the road, we'll see that this refugee community in Columbus will do much, much better than we anticipated today. That's the
energy. Kind of exciting.
Yeah. It is exciting. And if I may add 1 second to what Sudarshan is talking about, the landscape exactly is also changing. And I'm talking about literal landscapes. Bhutanese and Nepalese are so deeply connected. And that's one of the contrasts you were asking Doug earlier, mm-hmm. Between the Somalis and the Bhutanese-Nepali refugees. The Bhutanese-Nepalis are very connected to the land, and there are so many community gardens. And I visited so many homes of the newly purchased homes. Doug and I, when we do interviews or when we visit people for their new home that they purchased, the entire backyard is this garden. And self-sufficient garden. I'm not talking about it's pretty. No, it's efficient garden with all the vegetables that you can think about. And it's just so beautiful. It's really beautiful. And I hope, as the exhibition talks about, is your Nepali neighbors. And I hope you could really pay a visit to these homes.
One of the people we interviewed was saying that he had a hard time convincing his father to come to the United States because his father had heard that all the land was paved. And how was he going to be able to grow crops if everything was paved?
Amazing.
I know. It just gives a whole different light on this whole paved, the streets are paved with gold. Well, that's not necessarily a good thing to everybody, depending on where you're coming from. It's really interesting. And I've heard also about, I don't know if Tariq, you told me about this or not last week, but the neighborhoods, you know, they like to be around each other, which is not unusual when it comes to immigrant or refugee populations going back to the beginning of the country. People like to flock together. But that whole neighborhoods, you know, or parts of neighborhoods are being bought up, and that you look, it's not just one backyard, it's an entire spread of backyards that have been turned into, you know, urban farms.
Yeah. So the connection to the land is very deep, as Tariq was mentioning. We have done a gardening project, couple of gardening projects. Now this year what we are trying to do is we are collaborating with North YMCA. They have provided land. There are some churches who would provide land, and then the produce that this refugee's family will grow up. We are trying to set up a refugee farmers market right next to BNCC where the office is. So people want to be part of not only just last year, actually Bhutanese families who had garden in their backyard contributed to the Ohio Food Bank, the extra produce that they have. So we see this trend, and then, you know, they are growing organic to some extent. I don't know if it's verified or not, but to try to do organic. So this is amazing that we are connected to land. And every time, there's also the fact that we are buying homes pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So to be settled, to be with the land, I belong here, is very strongly connected with the culture that we came from.
One last question, because we're running out of time, but do they like Ohio soil? Do they like growing things here?
They like in summer.
Yeah.
All right. Good
one. All right. Good answer. Yeah, I hear you on that one. Sudarshan Piyakaro, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us. Thank you very
much. That's Sudarshan Piyakaro. He's executive director of the Bhutanese Nepali Community Center. Also, Tariq Tari, award-winning documentary photographer and the photographer involved with the new exhibit at the Ohio History Center. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
And Doug Rutledge, award-winning poet and essayist. Thank you as well.
Thank you very much for having us.
The exhibit, Bhutanese Nepali Neighbors, starts this weekend. It runs through January at the Ohio History Connection. For more information, Visit the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.